So we're back for another episode. Thank you all for joining us. So we will have another gubernatorial candidate up for this episode. And I just want to preface it, as I have the other episodes, RCA, Rural Community Alliance, is not endorsing any of these candidates. We're just simply providing a platform for our members and our supporters and friends to hear from these gubernatorial candidates. So thank you all for joining us again, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Representing Rural podcast by Rural Community Alliance. And we have another gubernatorial candidate that we'll be talking with today, Dr. Chris Jones. How are you doing today, Dr. Jones?
I'm great, great. Glad to be here having this conversation with you.
For sure. Thank you. So just let the people know a little bit about you and what inspired you to run.
Yeah, well, I'm a seventh generation Arkansan. So my family's been here for over 200 years. I'm the son of two preachers. And in fact, my dad is from Hughes, Arkansas. And his family got to Hughes, Arkansas because they own land in Mississippi. And one night in the middle of the night, his grandfather's friend came and said, "Hey, the Klan has found oil under your land, so you need to go." And so they packed up and moved across the river and ended up in Hughes. And my mom's from Stevens, and our family goes back over 200 years in the Stevens area, kind of Ouachita County. So I grew up, you know, typical Arkansan, riding dirt bikes, eating honeysuckle, fighting grasshoppers, getting bit by mosquitoes. that was the life. But it allowed me to explore, to ask questions. And my parents were always open to that. You know, even in church, you know, feeling the safety of community allowed me to be free to explore. And I always loved science. But at eight, when I was 8 years old, I had two encounters that really shifted my life. One was a Challenger accident when the space shuttle blew up. And Ron McNair was on there, and I learned about them over the course of that year in the third grade and found and decided, hey, I want to become an astronaut and I want to go to MIT. And then the other was I met Bill Clinton in the mall. And my interaction, he was a governor then, and my interaction was great. And my dad, and I asked my dad, "What does he do?" And he said, "He's a governor." And I said, "What's a governor?" He said, "Let's go look it up." So we went and we looked it up, and I found out that a governor could make a difference in people's lives. And at eight, I was like, that's what I want to do. So my journey took me to Morehouse College for physics and math, to MIT for nuclear engineering and a PhD in urban planning. My wife's an ER doc and an Air Force veteran, and we have three beautiful girls, and we came back home to serve Arkansas. And so here we are.
Here you are. Here you are. So that's kind of your story of how your family made it to this state, and what did you get to overall, like what inspired you to run for governor?
Yeah, I mean, it was that interaction. I mean, seeing how much interacting with Governor Clinton, how much he listened, how much he cared about people, and finding out that actually a governor can solve problems, and I always want to solve problems, and they can make a difference in people's lives. And the reason that was so important for me is because my grandfather, who had a third grade education, and he was a truck driver, would always say, you know, big man, get an education, because when you get it in your head, no one can take it out. But the other thing he said was, use every gift God gave you to serve someone else. So I was always looking for and listening for how I could serve, and I was inspired. And then I'll say now, like, so the question is, why now? Now, when I look back at my life's experiences, you know, I understand urban planning and planning in general, how large scale systems work together. I've run organizations before. I not only have experience in the problems we face now in infrastructure, in education. I was a dean for 10 years. I taught high school for a year. My mom's a lifelong educator. And in jobs and economic development, I've run nonprofits and run organizations, and I help start companies. But I also have the experience to see around the corner, to see what's to come, both challenges and opportunities. Having lived outside of the state, but always loved the state, I can sort of see two, three steps ahead where we might need to be. And I'm excited about both addressing those challenges that we face, but also seizing opportunities around the corner.
Now is the time for you, huh? Okay. So if elected, what are you hoping to accomplish as governor of Arkansas?
Yeah. So our overall campaign message is faith, hope, and hard work. And that sort of goes back to my own life's journey, you know, having the faith in the things that are unseen, having a hope that things can be different, and then being willing to put in the hard work. In terms of an agenda, as I've listened across the state, before I launched the campaign, I was listening. We listened when we launched and did a 75 county tour, hit all 75 counties from Huntsville to Harrison to Ashdown to Wabasica, Gould, Stevens, Stamps, you name it. And what I've heard consistently is that education matters, infrastructure matters, and economic development matters. And so our key theme is pretty simple. We want to spread PB&J across the state. And I'll tell you what PB&J is, but first I want to talk about why spreading is so important. And you think about a bad peanut butter and jelly sandwich. It's clumped. And so you take a bite and you might just get bread. In a good sandwich, you spread the peanut butter all over every crack, every crevice, and you layer layers of jelly all on top. And every bite you take, you get some jelly and some peanut butter. Well, PB&J for us is preschool, broadband, and jobs. And the reason that spreading is so important is because in the Delta and South Arkansas, the resources have been left out. They've been clumped in Central Arkansas and Northwest Arkansas. Now, you know, and you can spread PB&J without taking away from Central and Northwest Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And so we believe that every region across the state, North Central, Northeast, the Delta, South Central, Southwest, Central, West, we all need resources, particularly preschool, which is education, broadband, which we all need. We couldn't have this conversation if not for broadband.
For sure.
And jobs.
Yeah.
High quality jobs.
So an equitable PB&J sandwich.
There it is. And look, when I go back to my dad's hometown of Hughes, and I see how much devastation is there, you know, when the school closed.
Yeah.
And it became an abandoned building.
Yep.
And resources left and never came back in. But I also see that folks are still working hard.
Oh, yeah.
Still trying hard to hold everything together. So with a little bit of help, they can flourish. Mm-hmm. Same with Pine Bluff, where Main Street was popping. And then there was a period of time when it started to collapse. But now with the reinvestment in Pine Bluff, you're starting to see growth again. We can do that in every small town across the state. And to me, that's what's going to push the entire state up.
Right. So you brought up Hughes. I'm sitting in the former Elaine High School building. So we kind of went through the same situation, but long, long, long ago, 2006 was when this district was mandated to consolidate with another district. So it took a while, but, you know, RCA, we started the cybersecurity IT training, and we brought it to five of the community. So we, of course, we're looking for a way to reuse these buildings and make it spaces for our community. So on that same line, that being that, you know, Elaine went through this whole consolidation, Hughes, the same thing. What would be your way of uplifting these communities? I know you went into it a little bit, but specifically, these communities are all across the state. We have Perrin, which is in Central Saline County. Yep. We have Delight down there in Southwest, Parkin up there. So what would be your plan to help these communities? Because families, children still live here.
Right. Piggott, Rector, you know. Here's the deal. I think first you start from the philosophy, the idea, the belief that these communities have assets. And it's a positive asset-based thinking as opposed to a deficit-based. You know, some people look at communities and say, oh, there's an abandoned building. That's nothing but devastation. Let's keep on moving. Mm-hmm. Well, you saw an abandoned building and saw an asset. And by the way, the work that you all are doing in cybersecurity and IT is, to me, the sort of around the corner thinking. It's a growing and booming industry, and it's an opportunity for us to train people to take advantage of that growing and booming industry. That's sort of an around the corner thinking. But I'll give you a definite example. Eliza Miller, the Eliza Miller School in Helena, West Helena. It was an abandoned building. The community got together and said, this is an asset. And when I was at the Arkansas Regional Innovation Hub, we worked with the Eliza Miller School, the community, the various groups there, and said, hey, we can help you create an innovation hub. So now that building is the Eliza Miller Opportunity Hub, mm-hmm. where they're supporting small businesses. They're creating a farm to table network. They're doing training for residents there. They're offering office space for people to come in and house their business. That's the way I see across the state, you know, how we can revitalize some of these old buildings, again, with a little bit of infrastructure investment, with surety of broadband, with developing the workforce by starting with pre-K. And pre-K not only helps the student, it also helps the families. Because if my kid's going to pre-K, now I'm freed up to go to work, to start my business, to do things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an example in the community of what working directly with the community, it now has flourished into a vibrant place. Mm-hmm. We can do that all across the state.
Yep. I know my story of when my son was in pre-K, I guess daycare. I had to work another job just to fund him going to daycare. That's not a unique story. So what would you do around, well, you mentioned pre-K, but that's 3 and 4, right? That's a 3 and 4 year old age.
Absolutely.
So would you do kind of the same thing for those before they get to that age? So parents wouldn't have to work another job to fund daycare and things like quality daycare.
I mean, pre-K is a part of the, it's a piece of the overall infrastructure, right? Of the overall system. You know, and when I think about it, as you mentioned, their parents who, by the time you finish working and you've been away from your kid, you just barely have enough to pay for pre-K, for childcare. Mm-hmm. And so some people make the choice to just stay home.
Yeah.
And they're keeping their kids at home. And we know that kids that go to pre-K are more likely to read by third grade. They're more likely to read at grade level. They're more likely to graduate on time from college. They're less likely to go to prison, and they're more likely to have a living wage job. So pre-K is an important block that goes in. But I'm glad you brought the other point though. As we put the pre-K block in different places, places that don't even have anything, mm-hmm. then we can then add another layer of after school time for K to 12.
Yeah.
We add another layer of after school and out of school network. So the Arkansas Out of School Network, that's doing a phenomenal job.
Yeah.
We add another layer of before three-year-olds for childcare and making sure it's quality across the board. We add a layer of making sure that we're feeding kids breakfast, lunch, and snacks. Because at the end of the day, if I'm hungry, I can't focus. Mm-hmm. And so to me, but the key part is that big rock of pre-K. Once you get the big rock of pre-K in place, then you can begin to build things around it. And again, there are some places that already have pre-K. We support that. Mm-hmm. The thing about Arkansas, we did a great job years ago. We started the ABC program, A Better Chance. We started with a $11 million investment. And then over the next 10 years, we put $100 million in that program. But then over the last 10 years, we only put like $2 million into it. Mm-hmm. So that program itself is grossly underfunded, and it needs to be expanded to cover the whole state. So those are tangible things that we can do that I believe will begin to set up small communities for success. And that's the key.
Okay. I guess in the same vein of education, I attended the debates, APA Day of Debates last week.
Yeah.
And I'm really concerned about K-12 public education, mm-hmm. Especially for rural places, especially for districts that are in the Delta. So what would be your K-12 education plan? What would you want to see? What would you, what would be your plan for rural districts and districts that are in the Delta? What would be your plan for those places? All over for sure, but I'm going to be selfish with asking about rural places.
Of course. I mean, and here's the thing about it is, Arkansas won't flourish until the Delta and South Arkansas and very, 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 very rural places flourish, period. We won't. So there are a couple of things. You know, one, my mom's a lifelong educator, and she was an educator of educators as well. She retired only because she had a stroke. And after that, she, you know, we made her stop going in, but she loved it. And I bring that up to say that there are so many educators that love what they do, and they're really good at it, and they're exhausted, and we're wearing them out, and we're stretching them thin, and then we're stretching them some more, and we're not giving them the frontline supports that they need. So a few things that matter. One, we have to pay our teachers well. We have to pay our educators well, K to 12 across the board. But that also means for areas that are more difficult for people to go to, meaning folks don't often want to go to DeWitt. Folks don't want to go to Stamps or Gould in terms of large numbers. Mm-hmm. We incentivize it. You incentivize it by giving them extra pay. You incentivize it by, you know, providing some supports for purchasing a house in that area. Like, there are things you can do to incentivize folks going to very, very rural areas. That's one step. The other piece, you know, sort of as I think about, I'm reflecting on my own hometown of Pine Bluff. Last statistic I looked at, there are about 90% of the kids in Pine Bluff that do not read at grade level. Mm. So how do you support? And this is the case for so many rural communities. You go in, and there's AR Reads as a program that already exists and successful, and you ensure that we're investing in our kids so that they're reading at grade level. Because if I read at grade level, I'm more likely to actually show up in school, and I'm less likely to act crazy in school, yep, and act up, which then improves the environment, which then gives teachers the space to actually teach and educate, which is what they want to do. So those are just a couple of things in terms of the K to 12 pipeline. You know, of course, we need to bring back arts. I'm a huge science guy, science and engineering, but the science, technology, engineering, and math does not work unless you also bring the creativity and the arts part in. That's what makes it work. And we have to take care of our body as well. So we need to make sure the kids are spending time exercising and outside. Now, of course, we can get into the nuances of how do we move away from the testing culture into a sort of critical thinking learning culture. Those things matter and would help, and particularly in the most rural areas. So, and then actually I will say one other thing. Our facilities are in many places are just trash. Oof. They're just outright trash. I'm sorry. Hate to be so blunt. Well, but you know, when you're sitting in a place and there's mold on the walls, mm-hmm, when the windows are cracked, when you walk into a room and it feels like the ceiling might cave in on you, it's really hard to educate in those spaces.
Yep.
So we need to provide our schools with the highest level of quality in terms of the environment, because our youth are our most precious asset, and so we need to invest in it as if they are.
Yeah. I don't think that's been realized enough how much the spaces, especially put yourself in a child's shoes. You're in this space for most of the day, then you're awake.
Yeah.
And I mean, especially these days, they're so smart. They see that this is not the best facility, or people in another location have better things than we do. And that for sure, you know, has an impact on behavior, you know, in everything, I feel. So I mean, that you're right about that. I know it wasn't this past session, so it had to be 19. The funding structure did change a little bit. So districts that are poor will be able to receive more funding as far as facilities are concerned, but there's still a lot of work that needs to be done around it. So I'm with
you. We have infrastructure dollars from the federal government.
Yes.
That we could use. And unfortunately, you know, there are good things to say about this administration, but they also are sending back $146 million.
Oh, yeah.
Or turning it down. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we have to process where we make our investments.
Yeah.
And while I understand the economic need for jobs in communities, and I understand the critical need for safety. We need safe communities. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, violent criminals, folks who have done violent crimes need to be locked up. You know, folks who have mental conditions need to be served appropriately. We don't have enough mental health services because that's what spirals people in as well. But our investment does not need to go to prison expansion. It needs to go to pre-K. Yeah. And prisons should not be an economic tool for communities. That's not solving the underlying problem. If your police officers don't have jobs, let's solve the problem. And that's what we're not doing. We're putting a Band-Aid over a problem by building prisons as opposed to solving the underlying economic problems. And as governor, I want to solve the underlying economic problems, particularly for our communities that are smaller, less resources, and most often left out.
I know there, in conversations that I've been in on a national level, they're kind of concerned, not just with Arkansas, but with other states around them, not really spending down the funds, the ESSER funds and things like that. So, and I understand, you know, it's this big influx of money and some are, you know, worried about if they can spend it on certain things. But I'm gonna tell you, and I want to have a conversation with her. Mm-hmm. Dr. Tiffany Hardrick, mm-hmm. down in Forest City. I think she could give a lesson.
All right now.
On what to do with your ESSER funds and funding, period. Just right. being innovative with that funding. The whole CDL program that they were able to do and other things. I follow their Facebook page, so I think I'm a fan. I am a fan at this point.
I love it.
I wanted to her to have the opportunity to kind of share the insight with other districts on like what you can do, the possibilities, because I see this energy building and it's just beautiful to witness from, you know.
You bring up two important points. And one, we have solutions in our communities across the state. Mm-hmm. We have the solutions and the people who've solved the problems and are solving the problems. Let's lift those folks up.
Yeah.
You know, let's say, hey, you know, here's a model that's working in Hamburg. Here's a model that's working in Huntsville. Let's lift it up and see if it can work elsewhere. The other piece is that we make things more complicated than they should be.
Yeah.
You know, look, a lot of times I can say it ain't rocket science. And I know rocket science, so I can tell you the difference. If you go to our website, our Department of Education website, that's more difficult to navigate than rocket science is. You know, you go to our Department of Motor Vehicles, our Secretary of State website. Those are more difficult to navigate than it is for me to navigate a third order differential equation to get a moon, a spaceship to Mars. And it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah. Yep, that's so true.
But that's something we can fix, both of those. We can lift up people and shine a light on the leaders in communities that are actually doing the work. And we can completely simplify this process that's way too complex right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think we already went over my next question, which is what are you committing to do if elected? And I think you already hit everything, but is there anything you think you may have forgotten or you missed out that you're committing to do, that you're steadfast, that this is something that you will do if elected?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, and this is because I've heard it across the board in all the 75 counties I've been to, again, from Louisville to West Memphis, and that's preschool, broadband, and jobs. We need preschool everywhere. We need broadband everywhere. And we need a focus, an economic development focus in particularly the smaller areas, particularly the rural areas, and small in number, not small in might, not small in genius, not small in heart. The sort of other key pieces that, you know, I think about, you know, one is, I would say it's not tangible. You can't get your hands on it, but it's real. I believe that the people most impacted by decisions need to be at the table when decisions are made. Mm-hmm. And for too long, Pine Bluff, Hughes, Stevens, McNeil, Magnolia, Wabasica, Gould, they're not at the table. Mm-hmm. So the governor appoints almost 1,000 seats to boards and commissions.
Yeah.
It needs to be folks outside of Little Rock and Northwest Arkansas on there as well. and they need to have an authentic voice. By doing that, then we create a table that can actually solve problems for everyone. That then allows us to do a couple other things that are very important, which are healthcare, ensuring that our rural places have healthcare. My mom, I mentioned she had a stroke. Now, the healthcare in Pine Bluff is good. The healthcare in terms of the state in Little Rock is stronger. She happened to be in Little Rock when she had that stroke, and I was watching her. She was in the car, and I saw her face droop and her speech slur, and we immediately called the ambulance, and within 5 minutes, she was in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Within 5 minutes. Now, imagine if she was in Arkansas City. Mm. Imagine if she was in Diamond City.
Yeah.
And in fact, in Madison County, they only have 2 ambulances. And a man died of a heart attack because the ambulance was on the other side of the county. Mm. And if it had been there, and that makes no sense.
Right.
So healthcare matters in our rural areas if we really care about them. And then of course, our voice matters, and that's voting rights. You know, making sure that everyone has access to voting rights. And we're closing voting polls. We're putting in barriers to voting. And that's the way we use our influence and our power. So those things would matter as well. Creating a table where there's an inclusive voice, healthcare, and voting rights.
You know, we have a vision for a just and thriving rural Arkansas. So when you touched on the whole ambulance situation, healthcare is, it has to be a part of all of this conversation. Mm-hmm. Even when we're talking about telehealth and things like that, but just the basic of the ambulance situation. I had a wreck in 18 and it took the ambulance, I know, over an hour to get to me. And one thing was the 911 address. And I know the last session, they did address some things around that as well. But it should never, you know, take that long. And it just makes it harder for people to stay in rural areas when they're faced with things like that, not even having access to the basics. So thank you for hitting on.
Can I add one other thing on that, please?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So we have this conversation about, is government too big or is government too small? We are government. it's us. In Arkansas, our motto is the people rule. So we are the government. But two, it should be serving us. You know, we should be serving each other. Now, what does that mean? That means that there's a certain role for the private sector. You know, private sector produces jobs. Private sector is, you know, an economic engine driver. There's a certain role for the nonprofit sector. And there's a role for the government. And one of the roles of the government is to provide this infrastructure that the private sector won't invest in and that the nonprofit sector can't directly address. Because it's not service oriented. It shouldn't. What does that mean? Our 911 and our emergency call system. The government should be providing towers and call systems so that then allow individuals to be safe. Mm-hmm. Quality education, that's a constitutional requirement.
Yeah.
So there are certain things, roads and bridges, safe roads and bridges.
Yes.
We have almost 200 bridges in Arkansas that are qualified as at the bottom of the barrel, which means they could collapse anytime. Over 200 bridges. Mm-hmm. So these are things that the private sector is not going to invest in building new bridges. And they shouldn't.
Right.
They need to be driving innovation. They need to be driving jobs. But the government sector can provide that foundation. If we do that, and I'm telling you, if small towns had broadband, the opportunity for quality education, and really basic important infrastructure, companies would come in to those areas.
I believe it.
So that's the role. And I think the government should stay in its lane, do what it does well, and then let everyone else do what they do well.
So what are some of the foreseen obstacles to accomplishing your PBJ, your equitable PB&J sandwich? What are some foreseen obstacles? I know things will pop up, you know, that no one will expect, like COVID did and things like that. But what are some things that you know now that going in, if you're elected, okay, this is something that I'll have to tackle and work on?
Yeah, I mean, one big one, you know, it always comes back to money. And how are people going to decide where to make investments and where not to make investments? And so if there's a challenge, you know, certainly to say, hey, doing A will cost $100 million to make sure it's equitably spread. Doing B will cost $100 million to make sure it's equitably spread, but we only have $150 million. So how do you make those decisions? Mm-hmm. The challenge is maintaining a lens that lifts up the most disconnected and vulnerable and marginalized and left out while making those decisions. And when I say the challenge is, it's only a challenge because our system has run so often off a small group of people making decisions for everyone. And so so we don't even know how to bring somebody from Hamburg to the table to talk to somebody from Little Rock or Fayetteville about an issue that cuts across both areas. The good thing is that when I did my work at Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative in Boston, that was a core part of what we did. We brought CEOs together with first generation immigrants who were residents in the neighborhood, who barely spoke English and who didn't have any education in America. And collectively, they brought their collective brilliance, and everyone was brilliant, to the table, and that's how we solve the problems. That's what we can do in Arkansas. You don't need a PhD to have a solution to problems. You need a seat at the table and a voice at the table. So I think that's one big barrier. You know, I think the other barrier is ensuring that people stay engaged. But for oftentimes, there's excitement around an election. There's excitement around an issue. And what we need to do is stay engaged in between big issues and stay engaged in between big elections. I think you solve that by creating structure and structure and opportunity for people to be engaged. So those are the two big things that I think would stand out. Of course, there'll be folks that disagree, but I believe you can always find key points where you can latch on to people. Mm-hmm. And let me give you one more, actually. So my wife is the state medical director for disaster preparedness. She's trained and prepared. She served in Afghanistan. She was working the finish line at the Boston Marathon bombing, working as an ER doc. So she saw it, experienced it, felt it, right. But she has a rich experience with preparedness. And one of our challenges is not being prepared for the unexpected that will certainly come. We know another pandemic will come at some point. It's going to be unexpected. How do we prepare for it? We know tornadoes are going to come. They're going to be unexpected, but how do we prepare for them? Like, we know these things will come. It'll be unexpected when it arrives, but we should be ready. And as governor, I would work to make sure that we are ready for the unexpected, because when we're ready for the unexpected, we can recover and move on very quickly. And that's what we should do.
I know I have some more questions. I know the Biden administration, they were here last week, I think, doing an announcement around watershed funding. And yes. When you mentioned natural disasters, that's what popped up in my head. So
it's 93 million, 92 million?
It was a nice little piece. Yeah. Nice and little it job. Was for, I think, Phillips, like counties in the Delta that have experienced significant flooding.
Yes.
And there are more moves around making USDA funding or federal funding, period, more accessible to rural communities. So in that same vein of you saying that structure is needed for people to stay engaged, what advice would you give to communities to kind of ready themselves for applying for their federal funding or petitioning their cities? Because sometimes we have some communities have mayors that may be comfortable in situations where, you know, where they are not bringing anything there. So what advice would you give to communities that have been disengaged intentionally over the years to really get out there and speak up and advocate for themselves?
Yeah, I would say don't lower your voice. You know, keep speaking up. Don't be embarrassed by not knowing. And look, there, what I realize is that I know less than 1% of 1% of 1% of 1% of stuff. So, like, there's way more I don't know than what I do know. So every day I wake up, like, I get to learn something new. And a lot of times communities, because you're not in the seat of power and influence, because you don't have a lot of resources, it readily, you know, a lot of the standard resources readily available. You got resources, they don't have any standard ones. Mm-hmm. We think that, well, I should take a step back and I should stay quiet, or I don't deserve this or that. Every community in Arkansas deserves to be served, period. And so what we, my advice is to continually and constantly speak up, continually and constantly ask. If you feel a pain point, just speak, to talk about it. Hey, I can't figure out how to solve this problem. You know, who can I talk to? The person A can't give you an answer. Tell them, send me to person B. So don't give up on pounding the drum and making the drum beat is one piece of advice that I would give. You know, I think the other piece of advice I would give is there's power in coming together, right? So regions could come together. You get two or three counties that are close, that are co-located. Now, instead of one county having to carry the load, we get three counties together and say, well, let's first sit down and figure out what's the landscape. What do we know that's available and what's not available? What are the challenges? What do we know? Because in Clay County, in Craighead County, there are several points and several levees that are at the point of failing. And those levees, when it rains, they create floods that wash off into farms, which decreases the productivity of those farms. They've gotten together and sort of spoken out about, well, here's the challenge. How do we get resources to address the challenge? And they're getting some resources. So this idea of, let me work with my neighbors on problems that they probably have as well, and create these regional clusters that can then solve the problem or get the resources.
Yep, regionalism. Yep. We do our work in regions. So that's exciting to hear. And I feel like more from even the government standpoint, they're starting to realize that, you know, we will fare better if we work in regions. And so I'm ready to see that all develop. I feel like I have so many questions in my head to ask you that I didn't write down, but okay. I'll put a pin in it right now, and hopefully I can catch up with you another time, or invite you back closer to November. If you pass the primary.
There you go. May 24th. Early voting starts May 9th. Let's get as many folks out to vote as possible. And here's the thing, I'll say this. Number one, it's critical that we all go vote.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Choose who you want to vote for, as long as you go vote. Number two, I would love for folks to vote for me. I would love for people to pick up a Democratic ballot. And whether you're Democrat, Independent, Republican, you can still pick up the Democratic ballot and vote Chris Jones for governor. But most importantly, I want you to vote. Like that is the key. You got to get out. And the reason that's important, let me tell you a quick story. You know Ayanna Pressley?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She's a Congresswoman, Ayanna Pressley?
Mm-hmm.
So before she was elected, I was actually in her district. And so I knew her when she was a community activist.
Okay.
And the congressperson, Mike Capuano, came to my office when I was running the organization, Dudley Shoe Neighborhood Initiative. And he sat down with me and he said, the reason I don't come to your community is because y'all don't vote. He looked me in the face and said that.
Wow.
And Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley knew that that was what was going on. She got folks to show up and vote. And after they voted, she continued to listen.
Wow.
Now you might not always have a Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley.
Right.
You more likely have a congressman, Mike Capuano. But get this, he was sharing his thinking. If we show up and vote, then leaders will show up in the community. It should not be that way, but it's true.
It's the truth, yeah.
The places that vote the most are where elected officials go. Now, as I am running a race that says we're going to all 75 counties, whether you currently vote or not, because we want to encourage everyone to ultimately vote. And if I'm blessed to serve as governor, I will still serve all 75 counties, whether you voted for me or not, or whether you didn't vote at all. But the importance is not everyone thinks like that. So how do you get resources? You show up and vote. Even if you, I'm not saying who to vote for, I'm not saying how many people to vote for, but the number of folks that showed up by community to vote is going to drive the resources that get to that community. So go vote.
So in addition to that, do you have any other parting words where they can find more information about you and your campaign?
Yeah, you can follow us on social media. It's Jones for AR. Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, LinkedIn. You can go to our website at chrisforgovernor.com. That's chrisforgovernor.com. I'm out and about. I'll be in West Memphis later today. I'm popping up all over the place. So if there's something going on, I'd love to show up and meet with folks. Doesn't matter the size of the group. I'm happy to have conversations because I can learn from one person as much as I can learn from 100 people. So we want this to be an engaging experience. Again, chrisforgovernor.com. And I'm excited about really pushing the idea of faith, hope, and hard work, because that's what our campaign is about. And I'm also excited about pushing the agenda of equitably spreading PB&J across the state, because that's what's key.
Well, thank you for giving me your time.
And I thank you.
I know, I thank myself first.
There you go. I love it.
But thank you for giving me your time today. I know you're very busy. Like you said, folks, early voting starts May 9th. If you can't get out during that period of May 9th through May, I'm drawing a blank. Is it May 21st?
Early voting period, yep.
But May 24th, if nothing else, if you can't make it. So thank you again, and you enjoy the rest of your day. I try to anyways.
I will. You do the same, okay?
All right. You take care. Thank you all for joining us for another episode of the Representing Rural Podcast by Rural Community Alliance. This episode will conclude our conversations with gubernatorial candidates, at least for the primary period anyways. I hope to have whoever the candidates are in the November election back on around that time. But after this week, we'll go back to the more local election, school board, mayor, county judge, someone is running for rep or senator in your area. And if you know someone that would like to come on, just email us at rca@thenewrural.org. That's rca@thenewrural.org. I'll put that information in this episode's description. I only have one rural power move for today, and it will probably be in my Rolodex until after the primary election. And that is to make sure you get on VoterView and check your registration, your voter registration. Make sure everything is good and up to date. And also make sure you're aware of your polling location. You will need to make sure that you're aware of your polling location. That's all I have for this week. And until next time, you all take care.